From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Later tonight, a new twist to 2012 with William Gladstone, the 12. That'll be the last hour of the program tonight. Our main guest starts in just a few moments. Hey, by the way, check out Google's homepage, Crop Formation and a UFO. It was up there just a few minutes ago. I think it's still there. It's kind of neat. Sad news to report tonight. Patrick Swayze, the actor who danced his way into the moviegoers' hearts with Dirty Dancing and then broke hearts with Ghost, has died after a battle with pancreatic cancer. He was 57 years old. Fans of the actor were saddened to learn that in March of 2008, Swayze was suffering from a particularly deadly form of cancer. He kept working despite the diagnosis, putting together a memoir with his wife and shooting The Beast, which was an A&E drama series for which he had already made the pilot. Swayze said he opted not to use painkilling drugs while making The Beast because they would have taken the edge off his performance. The show drew a respectable 1.3 million viewers when the 13 episodes ran in 2009, but A&E said that it had reluctantly decided not to renew it for the second season. I will always remember his performance in the movie Ghost. Producer Tom Danheiser and I were at a dinner meeting 2 years ago here in L.A. when we spotted Patrick Swayze at a nearby table. Tom, being the enterprising producer, went over there to talk to Patrick to try to get him to appear on Coast to Coast.
We almost did. He was a heck of a nice guy, and he let me sit there for about, oh, I don't know, 5-10 minutes and talk to him. And, you know, I told him about the show, and he seemed very interested, and he gave me the right people to contact. I contacted him a few days later, but we all know
he started getting sick after
that.
Yeah,
and so I never got answers, and so we kind of figured.
You know, in a city that relishes itself on superstars and stars, some of whom we know, some of whom you really can't approach when you see them outside, Patrick Swayze was different, wasn't he?
Absolutely. He looked over and smiled and kind of waved over, and I kind of walked over there. I said, I'm sitting here with Patrick Swayze? And I just introduced myself and told him about the show, and he was very attentive.
Yeah, he'll be missed.
Nice guy.
Swimming in pools disinfected with chlorine may increase the odds that a child will develop asthma or allergies, according to new research. The study found that teenagers who spent more than 1,000 hours swimming in chlorinated pools, either indoors or outdoors, had more than, listen to this, 8 times the risk of having asthma than did teens who primarily swam in pools using copper silver disinfecting methods. Yes, and what may be the scariest shower news since Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, a new study says shower heads can harbor tiny bacteria that come spraying into your face when you wash. People with normal immune systems have little to fear. But these microbes could be a concern, they say, for folks with things like cystic fibrosis or people who are undergoing cancer treatment or those that have a recent organ transplant. Researchers at the University of Colorado tested 45 showers in 5 states as part of a larger study of the microbiology of air and water in homes, schools, and public buildings. Now, their findings will appear in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences on Tuesday. In general, is it dangerous to take showers? Probably not, they say, if your immune system is not compromised in some way. But, like anything else, the risk is associated with it. The researchers offer some suggestions for those of you a little skittish now on taking showers. Getting all metal shower heads, they say, microbes have a harder time clinging to it. More than 1,000 cases of bunched parsley produced by Miranaka Farm of Moore Park, California, are being recalled because the product may be contaminated with salmonella, a leading cause of potentially life-threatening food poisoning. Each case contains 60 bunches of parsley and were distributed to retail and food service locations in Arizona, California, Colorado, Florida, Iowa, Illinois, Missouri, Tennessee, Texas, and Wisconsin. Jeff Nelkin, our food safety expert, on with us. Jeff, I love you, but you're on way too much. There's too much wrong with our food.
Well, again, you know, here's an example. Again, we have to investigate and find out, you know, how where the trail takes us. But, you know, it can be anything from the manure used, you know, as fertilizer, because, again, the source could be, you know, poultry and dairy. to the irrigation water that could be contaminated, could be lizards, you know, in the fields. So there are a lot of avenues, you know, for the possibility of salmonella, you know, entering into the processing of the parsley. Plus, remember, they usually take a bath water, you know, with chlorine in it, and they sanitize, and over a period of time, you know, because of the contaminants, the chlorine levels go up and down, so it's very possible that sometimes contamination can get through that system.
Jeff, if you've lived in one of these states that gets some of this parsley from this company, what would you do?
Definitely, I would be calling up the local health department because they would give us an update on the specifics with the code numbers and concerns that they may have.
All right. Thank you. Jeff Nelkin, food safety expert. His website, foodsafetycoach.com. A rocket experiment set to launch Tuesday aims to create artificial clouds at the outermost layers of Earth's atmosphere. The project, called Charge Aerosol Release Experiment, plans to trigger cloud formation around the rocket's exhaust particles. The clouds are intended to simulate natural occurring phenomena of clouds, some of which are at the highest level in the atmosphere. Now, if they ever tell you that they're not manipulating weather, don't believe them. Two of the so-called Bermuda Triangle's most mysterious disappearances in the late 1940s may have been solved. This is one of the feature stories at coasttocoastam.com. Scores of ships and planes are said to have vanished without trace over the decades in a vast triangular area of the ocean with imaginary points in Bermuda, Florida, and Puerto Rico. But a journalist, Tom Mangold from the BBC, says he's got some explanations for the disappearance of two British commercial planes in the area with the loss of 51 passengers and crew. One plane, he said, probably suffered from catastrophic technical failure as a result of poor design, while the other is likely to have run out of fuel. Of course, he only answers two of the disappearances. There have been thousands of planes and ships that have disappeared in the Bermuda Triangle. Osama bin Laden apparently said in a new audio tape that President Barack Obama's strategy in Afghanistan is hopeless, and he called on Americans to resolve the conflict with al-Qaeda by ending the war there and breaking the U.S. alliance with Israel. In a message marking the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, the al-Qaeda leader avoided his usual rhetoric of jihad and instead took a more analytical tone, claiming its differences with the U.S. stemmed from the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Doug Hagman monitors websites, terrorist websites. What do you think of this latest? Do you first of all think it is Osama bin Laden?
Well, George, thanks for having me on, by the way. Yeah, you know, it's kind of hard to say. I don't think we've seen any sufficient amount of proof of life with respect to this message or any of the previous messages over the last few years. So, you know what, I'm really not convinced that it is actually Osama bin Laden, and especially the keen sense he's got, or the speaker has in this case, the awareness of American politics, and the words that are being used. This particular message too represents a dramatic, a demonstrable shift in a change and a shift in focus. So it's kind of hard to say.
If it's him, he sounds kind of beaten down.
Well, you know, definitely the message comes from a weak vantage point or a weak point. Indeed, in this particular message, he does not really get into discussion about Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, or Chechnya, which he has in the past. Instead, this message is purely focused on U.S.-Israeli relations. And it's interesting, too, his use of particular words, Arabic words that describe Obama. In this particular message, he is obliquely referring to the military-industrial complex, which is he's saying Obama has been rendered weak and powerless by this global military-industrial complex, which is kind of interesting. And I think we've been kind of saying the same thing in different ways.
All right, Doug, thank you. Doug's website, homelandsecurityus.com. It'll be on our Twitter feed, which you can find at coasttocoastam.com. The expected release on Monday of the Iraqi television reporter jailed for throwing his shoes at former President George W. Bush has been postponed now. Two of his brothers said this, citing delays in processing his paperwork. A scientist claims that he can cure HIV by injecting patients with perfume. I kid you not. This scientist is from Kazakhstan. He told the country's news agency, but it has to be expensive perfume. He's serious. Medics out there have condemned the treatment, saying it is illegal. Injecting perfume in the blood could cause harm not only to HIV patients, but also healthy people as well. You know, Americans have been fascinated by the occult since our nation's inception. In a moment, we will talk with Mitch Horowitz, Occult America, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Tonight's main guest, Mitch Horowitz, is the editor and writer with a lifelong interest in man's search for meaning. He is the editor-in-chief of Tarcher Penguin in New York and is one of the leading publishers and writers on the occult. Here he is on Coast to Coast. Mitch, welcome back. Been a long time.
Thank you, sir. Glad to be here.
Likewise. Great work here in Occult America, dealing with the mysticism of our nation and how things were shaped. Nice job indeed. Give me your take on the occult, because some people, I hear two different explanations. One is the dabbling of the dark forces and things like that. And the other is that it's almost a quasi-science. What's your take on it?
Well, it's interesting. I don't see the occult as representing the dark side. The occult does mean a spirituality that is secretive, that is hidden from common view. And it really has to do with the ability to contact some kind of an invisible world or another dimension that runs parallel to our own. Some people might call this the afterlife. Some people call it a hidden dimension that runs parallel to us. And there are certain occult arts like astrology or tarot or numerology that we can use to tap information from this hidden world. That's how the occult has been practiced in the West, and it has its higher and lower uses. In the hands of people with a strong ethical sense, the occult can be used for great good. For people who are dark and interested in manipulation, the occult can be a tool for evil, but it doesn't have to be.
Now, those who practice the evil end of it, are they more of Luciferians or Satan worshipers?
I don't really use those terms myself, because I don't believe there ever was a tradition of Satan worship here in the West. Back in late antiquity, when the church and the pagan powers were in a struggle for religious domination of the Western world, at that point, the church began to refer to the old religion, the nature cults, the people who practiced ancient arts, like alchemy and spirit divination. They began to refer to the old religion as Satan worship or black magic. That was a way in which pagan worshipers never actually viewed themselves. So we start to see the term Satan and Lucifer in a negative sense coming out of the church, never coming out of the occult. To me, you know, the dark side of the occult is the same as the dark side of any religion. It's when people want to exclude others. It's when people want to manipulate others. But I don't view Satan worship or Lucifer worship as something that really ever had deep roots in the West. It was a kind of a name-calling that was begun by the church to discredit the old religion that it wanted to wipe away, basically.
Talk about the dark side. You're over there in New York, our monster station there, WABC. You're deep into the wee hours tonight, Mitch.
Oh, yes, sir. Yeah, we keep late hours in this house, actually. So I'm happy to be up with you.
How did you get interested in writing about the occult? And what pushed you in that direction?
Well, for many, many years as a publisher, I have been publishing different strains of occult thought, metaphysical thought, New Age thought, and I began to realize that a lot of the American occultists, going way back to the founding of this country and even back to its colonial days, were different from the kinds of occultists that you found in Europe. Occultists in Europe very frequently liked to form into secret societies. They were very exclusive. They liked to hide these ideas away, and they were also interested in finding a kind of moral freedom. I don't equate that with Satan worship, but they wanted to get out from under what they saw as the tired, restricting morals of society. American occultists were very different. These folks wanted to evangelize. They wanted to take occult ideas like hypnotism, channeling, meditation, mm-hmm.
mind-body healing, and use them as tools of self-help. American occultists, going way back to the dawn of the nation, believed that arcane religious ideas could help promote a kind of social progress, could help ordinary folks in their day-to-day lives. They didn't want to hide these ideas. They wanted to evangelize them. So there was this tone in the American occult from the very beginning that was quite different from Europe. The American occultists wanted to recreate occult ideas as tools of self-help, and they succeeded because in many respects, so many of these ideas, from mind-body healing to motivational thinking that make up today's therapeutic spirituality or New Age spirituality, they have their roots directly in occult tradition in this country.
Why do so many people, though, when they hear the word occult, think it has to do with something very negative, with something very evil?
You know, it's a matter of perspective.
And they do, though, don't they? Most of them?
Many people do have negative associations with that word, absolutely. People think it's something scary. They think it's something sinister. But it all depends on our perspective, really. You know, you turn on the History Channel on any given night, and you'll see a documentary about the occult influences on Hitler or the Third Reich.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, I call that into question because actually during the Third Reich, astrologers and other occultists were rounded up and murdered along with lots of other so-called undesirables in Nazi Germany. And Hitler would adopt symbols from occult organizations and then turn around thereafter and persecute and murder the people who ran those same organizations. So I question some of that stuff. But then you have a figure like Gandhi, one of the great democratic leaders of the 20th century or of any century. He was profoundly influenced by occult ideas. He very explicitly stated in his letters and in his diaries that the occult organization Theosophy had brought him back to the study of Hinduism, had brought him back to a belief in the universality, in the equality of all religions. This was a terrific turning point in Gandhi's life. He credited occult ideas with bringing him around to some of the principles of nonviolence and human equality that later shaped his political career. But all people want to do is pay attention to an occult connection to the Third Reich, and they ignore Gandhi altogether. So, you know, there's a question of perspective here. Occultism is no better or no worse than any other religious tradition. It just has a bad name because, in a sense, the pagan world lost the struggle for the Western mind. It lost the struggle for Western religion. And it was classified as being evil, whereas it was really just part of another and different worldview that the church prevailed over. But there's no reason to view occultism as being historically negative or having anything different about it, really, than any other religious tradition.
When I was a young teenager, I picked up a book on astral projection by Sylvan Muldoon and Haywood Carrington, The Projection of the Astral Body. That didn't make me an occultist, did it? Just
no,
by reading
well,
that book?
You know, it's an interesting question. I mean, no one has to put that label on themselves, but that is an occult idea, you know. It's very interesting. I mean, if you go back to the Renaissance in the early 1500s, there was a man named Cornelius Agrippa who wrote these books of occult philosophy. He really helped popularize occult in the Western world at that time. He wrote about things like that. He was very interested in talking to angels, in projecting a spirit form, in communicating with beings from other dimensions. So, in a sense, I would say that doesn't make you an occultist, but that is an occult area of interest.
Mitch, this is a fascinating subject, and there's so much to talk with you about, so I'm glad we've got you for 3 hours as we go through this. Did you encounter any difficulties putting the Occult America book together?
Wow. Well, the only difficulties were who to include and who not to include, because the occult has touched so many different aspects of American history. It has affected our politics. It has really created the New Age culture, the culture of therapeutic spirituality that exists not only on the New Age, but even within conservative, Christian, or evangelical ministries. So sometimes I just had to make some very tough judgment calls about who stayed in and who went out. And ultimately, I tried to cover every theme, even though I couldn't cover every individual.
Well, when we come back, we'll find out who stayed in on Coast to Coast AM. And that dedicated to the memory of Patrick Swayze, who died at the age of 57 years old today. We'll be back in a moment with Mitch Horowitz as we talk about Occult America on Coast to Coast AM. Mitch, what can you tell us about the how things started in the United States and how a cult played a part of it?
You know, it's interesting. The occult has really been with us not only since the dawning of this country, but even since the days of the American colonies. In the mid-1600s, Central Europe was torn apart by a horrible war called the 30 Years' War. It decimated many parts of Germany. It decimated areas around Prague. These were very rich areas for the European occult. These were religiously liberal areas, and they were destroyed. So lots of Europeans attempted to cross the Atlantic and reach America. At the time, the American colonies were developing a reputation for being religiously liberal. William Penn had founded the city of Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. And even though at that time it was still just a small town, you had people of lots of different religious backgrounds living there. You had Mennonites. You had Quakers, you had radical offshoots of the Lutheran Church. So in the late 1600s, a small band of mystics and occultists managed to travel from central Germany to Philadelphia. They were led by a man named Johann Kelpius, and they founded a small mystical colony on the Wissahickon Creek just outside of Philly. And they practiced astrology, Kabbalah, numerology, various forms of esoteric Christianity. And even though their group was quite small, and it only lasted for a few years because Kelpius died of tuberculosis about 12 years after reaching America, word traveled back to Europe that the American colonies were a safe harbor for people with radical religious beliefs, for people with supernatural religious beliefs. So other occultists who were fleeing persecution in Europe or fleeing the destruction of the 30 Years' War and its aftermath, came to America. They founded a larger colony at Ephrata, Pennsylvania. A couple of generations later, a group that was being persecuted in England called the Shaking Quakers, or the Shakers, left Liverpool, and they came to New York City. And from New York City, they made their way up to the city of Albany, and they founded a colony up there in 1776. So the pattern was set. People with supernatural religious beliefs began to come to America to find safety, and word went out throughout Europe that the colonies, and later the United States, were a safe harbor for people with occult religious beliefs.
Did they end up in Salem at all?
You know, Salem was a very interesting anomaly in this country. Salem, of course, was the scene of this outburst of mob violence against these young girls who were accused of witchery.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about Salem, as bloody as it was and as violent as it was, it never repeated. There was a witch craze in Europe that went on for centuries, and who knows how many innocent people were killed. And it continued to go on well into the late 1700s. In the late 1700s, there was a young housemaid in the country of Switzerland who was beheaded on charges of being a witch. So this stuff really went on well into what we like to call the Age of Reason or the Age of Enlightenment. But in America, Salem, thankfully, was an anomaly. It was a horrible outcropping of violence, but it didn't repeat itself. It didn't set a pattern. So we talk about Salem today as this weird schism in our history, but fortunately, it was an exception.
Most of the founding fathers of this country were Freemasons. What was Freemasonry?
I take a very positive view of Freemasonry. It's funny, I talk to lots of folks who feel that Freemasonry is this sinister, manipulative organization, a hidden hand behind our politics, behind our finance. I take a completely different view. As you just mentioned, many of the founding fathers were Freemasons. That includes George Washington, Paul Revere, Benjamin Franklin, John Hancock. Now, Freemasonry, as I see it, was a very radical thought movement that came out of the Reformation in Europe. These were folks in the 1500s and 1600s who wanted to create an organization where people could pursue truth, could pursue meaning, could pursue every variety of religious ideas, mystical ideas, ecumenical ideas, without any government or church interference. They were a true thought movement of the Enlightenment. They were the real thing. And Freemasonry, for those reasons, was very popular in the American colonies. And Freemasonry held the belief that all religions should be permissible, should be allowable. They believed in religious liberty. They believed in religious toleration. So you had this as an influence on the lives and careers of people like Washington and Franklin. This was a very personal commitment. This was a very real commitment. And when the founding fathers devised the Great Seal of the United States, which now appears on the back of our dollar bill, and when they spoke of a new world order, as it appears, there's a Latin phrase that goes around the pyramid on the back of the dollar bill, annuit coeptus novos ordo seclorum, which roughly can be translated as God smiles on our new order of the ages. They didn't mean anything sinister by that. They saw it as a fresh break with the old world. They saw it as the creation of a nation where no church or government authority could get in the way of the individual's search for meaning. And there were all kinds of ways that this got expressed in the lives and the careers of figures like Washington and Franklin. So I think Masonry played a very positive role in instilling values of religious liberty and religious toleration in this nation. And it was interesting, there was a British army garrison outside of Boston in 1775 that granted the first Freemasonic charter to a group of black men, to a group of freed slaves. And they were permitted to form into an organization called African Lodge Number 1, which was affiliated with Masonry. And their eventually their organization became known as Prince Hall Masonry after their grand master, whose name was Prince Hall. Mm-hmm. They became the first black-led abolitionist movement in the United States. That was through the agencies of Freemasonry. So Freemasonry had a hand in helping shape abolitionism in this country. Freemasonry had a hand in helping instill values of religious liberty in this country. So I'm not a Freemason myself, but I take a very positive view of Masonry's role in the founding of America.
How has it gotten blown out of proportion?
People, well, gosh, there's all kinds of reasons why. You know, there was an episode. Masonry has, there are dark elements in Masonic history.
Aha!
Yes, sir.
Here we go.
In upstate New York, in the 1820s, there was a man named William Morgan, who was a disgruntled Freemason. And he was going to publish a manuscript that was supposed to reveal all of Masonry's secrets. William Morgan was harassed. William Morgan saw the print shop that held his manuscript burn down, and he eventually disappeared, and people believe he was murdered. He was probably drowned as his body, a body that was identified as his, washed up around Niagara Falls. Hmm. Anyway, people believed that there was a Freemasonic conspiracy to silence and murder William Morgan, this critic of Freemasonry. So a anti-Freemasonic movement began to sweep across the United States. There was a feeling at the time in the early to mid-1800s that Freemasonry did have a secret influence in the courts and in law enforcement. And there were anti-Masonic newspapers that sprang up around the country. There were anti-Masonic political parties that sent candidates into state legislatures. So there was this wave of anti-Masonry that swept through the country in the early to mid-1800s when people felt that Masonry really did have an undue influence in law enforcement and in the courts. So that left a lot of Americans with a bad taste around Freemasonry. Now, eventually that all settled down and that all died down. And after that, I think Freemasonry's political influence on the country really bottomed out. I don't think Freemasonry had a significant political influence after that, even though you did have presidents and lots of leaders of commerce who were Freemasons.
Sure.
The organization sort of, its influence was weakened. So, you know, that wave of anti-Masonry in the 1800s, among other things, left some Americans with a foul taste about Masonry.
What about the symbolism, for example, on the back of a dollar, the eye and the pyramid?
Yeah, it's a very, very alluring symbol. I believe that symbol was very heavily influenced by Freemasonry. The all-seeing eye is a symbol that goes back in Masonry to at least 1768. That's the earliest piece of documentation I've seen. So that symbol has been around for a while within Freemasonry. On the back of the dollar bill, we have this very mysterious image of an unfinished pyramid with an eye floating above it, and this expression around it, God smiles on our new order of the ages. I think the idea being expressed there is that worldly achievement, or this unfinished pyramid, is incomplete without some kind of inner knowing or inner knowledge represented by this hovering eye. Now, that image was commissioned by the Continental Congress beginning on July 4th, 1776. So that image has, in other words, that's the year that the design of the Great Seal began. It took a few years until it was actually completed. But that image has been with this republic for a long, long time. It did not appear on the back of our dollar bill, however, until 1935.
Mm-hmm.
It was put there by a Freemasonic president named Franklin Roosevelt, and the symbol was actually introduced to Roosevelt through his Secretary of Agriculture, a man who later became his vice president and who I write about quite a bit in the book, named Henry A. Wallace. Henry A. Wallace was a real explorer in the occult. He was very straightforward about this in his letters.
Deep into it?
Oh, deep into it. Oh, yes, sir. He was a theosophist when he was a young man. Theosophy is an occult organization with very deep roots in America. He was interested in astrology. He was interested in Tibetan Buddhism back when that was considered very exotic.
Sounds like my show.
Yes, right. He would have been a terrific guest.
He would have been.
He was interested in Native American mysticism and shamanism. Henry A. Wallace was for real. He grew up in Des Moines, Iowa, as part of a very influential farming family, and he was just a man who wanted to know how the world worked, and he wouldn't settle for the religion of his childhood, and he wouldn't settle for the answers that were given to him in childhood. So as he got older, he explored all kinds of ideas, including occult and esoteric ideas. Now, when Wallace came upon this symbol of the eye in the pyramid, he was very taken with this, because to him, the idea of a new order of the ages reminded him of the New Deal. Wallace would talk very explicitly about the need for a spiritual New Deal, or about the need for a New Deal of the ages. He felt that what was happening in the Roosevelt administration was another break with the past, just as significant as the break that the Founding Fathers had made with the British Crown. So Wallace found this symbol very alluring, and he thought that it heralded this new start that the New Deal was promising. And he did talk in speeches. He's on public record discussing the need for a kind of a spiritual New Deal, or a New Deal of the ages. Anyway, so Wallace brings this symbol to the attention of Franklin Roosevelt. And Roosevelt, who himself is a Freemason and who loves kind of grand and portentous imagery, Roosevelt thinks it's terrific. So Roosevelt personally supervises the placement of the Iron Pyramid on the back of the U.S. dollar bill, and he does an interesting thing. The Great Seal of the United States has a front and it has a back. On the front is the familiar American eagle, and on the back is this more arcane image of the eye in the pyramid.
Right.
Roosevelt personally designs the back of the dollar bill, and there are actually records of his handwriting on designs of the dollar bill. He personally designs the back of the dollar bill so that the mysterious pyramid is placed first if you're reading the bill from left to right. So it leaves Americans with the impression that the eye in the pyramid is the foremost image of our republic rather than the more familiar American eagle. Roosevelt seemed to be very purposeful about that. He liked this image of the eye in the pyramid. He seemed to like this idea of associating the New Deal with this new order of the ages. So he personally supervised the placement of the eye in the pyramid into the foremost position on the back of the dollar bill. And it's funny because it seems like one of those things that's been with us forever. But that image only appeared on the back of our bill in 1935.
That's amazing. Now, tell me a little bit, though, about this push through even presidencies, Abraham Lincoln, Nancy Reagan, all of them involved in the occult, right?
Yes, it's very interesting. You know, it's funny, the White House, the Supreme Court, all these places of power, they really just reflect the interests of society at large in certain ways. So in the mid-19th century, a movement swept America called spiritualism. It involved talking to the dead, it involved seances, spirit raps, and so forth.
Did some of the religious leaders at the time go
bonkers over this?
You know, it was funny. There were plenty of mainstream religious leaders who themselves were involved in spiritualism.
They were? Okay.
Absolutely. You know, one of the great things about American occultism, and something that I've found again and again, is that people could belong to mainstream religious faiths. They could be Lutheran. They could be Methodist. They could be Catholic. They could be Jewish. They could be members of mainstream churches or synagogues and still engage in occult practices. They didn't feel that they had to leave the religion of their household in order to sit at the seance table. And it was very interesting. In fact, a lot of occultists really, they never stopped calling themselves Christians. They never shedded a Christian moral outlook. They didn't have any problem marrying arcane beliefs to occult systems or to magical systems. It's a very, very interesting thing about America. So in the mid-19th century, this movement called spiritualism sweeps the country, and you have lots of mainstream folks involved in it. It was obviously a very different time in America. Lots of people died due to childhood diseases. Death was a very palpable presence, and there was no counseling. People didn't have support groups. People didn't have anywhere to go to get through the grief and the tragedy of losing a child. So they would frequently go to the seance table. That's the place mm-hmm. where they would find comfort. So Mary Todd Lincoln, who suffered through the death of two children and later, of course, suffered through the death of her husband, she became a committed spiritualist. And she seems to have influenced her husband in the matter, too, because there were seances held in the Lincoln White House. During the Civil War, Lincoln held one seance where he permitted a reporter from the Boston Gazette to be present. And during that seance, Lincoln seemed to be regarding the whole thing as kind of a novelty. I mean, in some ways, you could be a spiritualist or you could sit at the seance table without taking it all that seriously. It was also possible.
It's almost like a party scene.
Exactly. Exactly. It could almost be treated like a party game in a certain way. And that's what Lincoln seemed to have been doing at one of these seances. And he probably permitted a reporter to be present because he wanted to project the image of a commander-in-chief as someone who could be relaxed, at ease, who could enjoy a novelty the way that lots of other folks in the country were doing. But there's another record of a seance in the Civil War era White House, in which this was written about by a trance medium named Nettie Coburn Maynard. She published her memoirs in the late 19th century, and she claims that she, at the instigation of Mrs. Lincoln, was brought in to give a trance sitting to the president, and she went into this unconscious state. She did what today we would call channeling, and that she called upon these spirits, and these spirits urged Lincoln to sign the Emancipation Proclamation and said that if he did sign the Emancipation Proclamation, it would be the key accomplishment for which his presidency would be remembered. And it's interesting, you know, there's no way to prove or to disprove this account, but I've looked at this account very carefully, and I think it matches up. It's consistent with enough things that were going on at the time. The people in it, the things that are said, the interest of Mary Todd Lincoln in spiritualism, I think there are enough I's dotted and T's crossed that the account probably has some truth to it. And there's no question in my mind that there were seances held in the Lincoln White House.
When we come back at the top of the hour, Mitch, I want to talk with you about this push for positive thinking. It really does work, but how did that philosophy begin? We'll also talk about Ouija boards as well. We're talking with the author of Occult America, Mitch Horowitz. His website, MitchHorowitz.com, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com.